Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. During this episode, we are listening to NPR's Ron Elving, who recently visited Fort Wayne and gave a lecture asking, how deep is our commitment to democracy? This was followed by a Q&A, and Elving will continue answering questions momentarily. Enjoy the show.
Well, I have a question that kind of goes along with what you just said. It has to do with a common enemy. There's a lot of power and unity in a common enemy. And part of the attacks this week on Google from the administration is actually trying to stop the media, the whole media, from attacking them because they know that they could lose the whole thing with the right criticism. I'd like for you to comment on that and give us your ideas.
Yes, I do understand. I do understand that the president sits down and Googles his name and sees a lot of negative stuff. This I think would be disturbing for anyone, right? To see mostly bad things being written about them, especially when they know that there are lots and lots of people who feel very differently. And Donald Trump has every reason, not just because of the rally he had here in Indiana, not just because of the other rallies that he has, although those would obviously be a very bracing experience for any human being to stand up in front of a crowd that adores and hangs on every word. But he's got polls. He's got lots of indication that what he sees when he Googles his name is just wildly non-representative. He has every reason to think that. So he doesn't understand necessarily why that list of stories to read comes up the way it does. And he, I think, quite understandably or naturally thinks, somebody's cooking the books on me here. It may not be any one particular individual at Google, or it might be some evil person at Google who's going, I will not let anyone say anything good about Donald Trump. And that's actually not necessary because of the way Google works. I mean, if you Google anything, you're going to come up with things that have been hit on a lot, all right? And if you Google anything, you're going to see a lot of whatever criticism it may have gotten. And in the media and outside the media, Donald Trump has been a highly disruptive figure who, while he has fanatical following, also has fanatical opponents. And that's what makes pop on Google. That's what comes up when you go to Google. That's the way their algorithms work. So I think that all can probably be better made clear to him so that he doesn't necessarily think that that what's going on there is some evil plot. It might be evil, but it's not conscious in terms of just Donald Trump. It may be evil just to have these algorithms work that way. I mean, evil is a loaded word. It's certainly controversial. Yes.
Hi, my name is Deborah Bauer. Thank you for your talk. I have to say it was more optimistic than I expected, given the question that you posed. And I'm curious, probably many of you in this room read an op-ed yesterday in the New York Times by Paul Krugman that took a very pessimistic approach to what our commitment to democracy is, talking about his fear of where the institutions are generally and making kind of comparisons with potentially Poland and Hungary and if we could go down the lines of a move towards fascism. So I guess my question to you is if you think we're at the stage right now where just the vox populi, where voting is enough, or if there's something going on in the government, and I know you're probably very careful not to mention, talk about the president a lot, but, you know, he's in power, the GOP is in power. Is there a fear that you see as a very possible real fear that there's something going on with our institutions that maybe voting at this point isn't enough, and that gerrymandering and voter restrictions and everything else that, you know, people like Krugman are afraid of could compromise our democracy?
You know, I think actually it was Paul Krugman himself who said about somebody else that they had predicted five of the last two recessions. And somebody knows who actually said that. And who is it who originally said that? Yeah, but you get the drift, right? It's the kind of joke Krugman would make, too. And he is obviously a brilliant man and a wicked wit. But he is not necessarily right about everything, and no one is. And a Nobel Prize in one field is not necessarily an absolute right to voice the last word in every field.
He's not the only one.
I understand, of course, of course. And I'm concerned about this, too. I don't take quite the same approach of thinking that, you know, because it's happening in Poland, it's happening in Hungary, it's going to happen here. But I do see signs, you know, particularly with respect to the populist movement that becomes a nationalist movement, that becomes an exclusionist movement. And we've had those in the United States long before my grandfather got here from another country. And I'm sure many of us know the name of our first relative who was an American who came to the United States. So that's deeply troubling to me, any kind of real rejection of the idea of immigration or any real redefinition of the openness of our society. But I don't think that we have the history or the mix of cultural experiences that Poland and Hungary have, which are quite different. And I don't think that we are in danger of becoming that much like them. What troubles me is that we should be, in any sense, compared to the situation you're talking about in those two countries, which is very disturbing. At the same time, if there is a kind of American exceptionalism that I think everybody has to agree with, is that we have been exceptionally blessed as a place to have an experiment with the oceans, with the resources, with the extraordinary mix of people who have gone through so much to get here, back through all the generations, you know, from the Mayflower to the people who are struggling at the border today, and some of them, you know, separated from their children. Those are not necessarily all perfect people. I don't think they ever were. I don't think the people who came here in earlier generations were either. But it is disturbing to see that same sort of cultural pushback happening here in the great exceptional experiment of America that you see in European societies that have been much more ethnically defined and much more, you know, closed societies. Japan's another example, a country where homogeneity has been a huge value for a very, very long time. We're a different kind of country. We are a place that has had this exceptional set of gifts and blessings that has allowed us to conduct this experiment. And it disturbs me to see any kind of loss of faith in that. But I see it as troubled faith, not totally lost faith. And I think that sets us apart. And I do think that Paul Krugman in particular has a tendency to see the glass half empty, particularly when he really doesn't like the administration in power at that particular moment. I think if you looked at all the policies of the last administration and this administration, you would find that Krugman is unhappy about many of the things in the last administration as well. So, you know, he's a brilliant guy. He ought to have a column. I read it. I'm glad he's out there. I'm glad he's doing that. But I am not going to allow myself to be as downbeat.
So if it's not CBS and ABC and NBC anymore, and it's Facebook and Google, who is controlling the algorithms that you talked about? You seem to have some faith in the Google algorithms, but who is really controlling the algorithms of the things that we see on those two media sites?
Hmm. I still believe, and I'm, you know, prepared to be shown evidence to the contrary, but I still believe that this is essentially a mathematical and computerized operation. I can't prove it. I can't, you know, absolutely rule out that Sergey Brin or somebody else at Google sits down and says, you know, how should we respond to all these requests? And I don't think that they are fans of the administration, and even before the administration started talking about regulating them, they are obviously very concerned about the prospect of more regulation. You remember the spectacle of Mark Zuckerberg coming in for his griddle session with the Senate that turned out to be a griddle session for the Senate, because the senators sadly showed so much lack of information. One of the senators actually said, well, Facebook is free, isn't it? And he said, yes, sir. And he said, well, so how do you guys make money? Mercifully, that senator is retiring. But there were questions from other senators who are not retiring that were almost as clueless about what these enormous powers that are ruling much, or it's not ruling exactly, it's much more like determining. You know, they don't give orders, they just make things happen whether you want them to happen necessarily that way or not. But I don't think that that's because they're sitting there plotting how they want to change America. I wonder a little bit about Jeff Bezos, because he bought the Washington Post and bought a block. If you want to move to Washington, D.C., buy a block. You know? Don't worry about neighbors and separate houses and stuff. Just buy a block and make it all into your home. I recommend that. Really highly. So, I'd never heard of anybody doing that before, but that's what he did. And you know, his company has doubled in size in the last 5 years. And he bought the Washington Post, which chilled me, truly did. I have some, you know, longstanding feelings about the Washington Post, not all of them positive. My wife worked there for 25 years. But I did see it as an example of journalism more or less at its best in the United States, not always, but oftentimes and more often than most. And it disturbed me to see it bought by a mogul who had no previously demonstrated interest in any of the principles that I've been talking about, who was clearly interested in having a footprint in Washington. Some people thought he just wanted the real estate, by the way. And they moved it out of all the buildings it was in and moved it into floors of other buildings, took the publication of the actual printing presses out to the suburbs, and the entire block that was the Washington Post for the last 75, 80 years was raised. Big hole in the ground. Boom. Just like a lot of people would have liked to have done at some point in history. But then they put in a new office building. It's gleaming. It's there. It's fine. But the Washington Post happens someplace else and in a much, much smaller space, and has a somewhat different, although it looks the same on a paper and looks the same when you look at it online, it has a somewhat different feel, and it is not just the creature of Jeff Bezos. A lot of the journalists there, wonderful people, wonderful journalists, but you know they're all working for a guy who has ultimately another agenda. I don't see that yet in what's going on at the media companies. We're certainly trying. Because I think we're all a little bit terrified of the prospect of what was, as the president has described, that somehow somebody at that powerful place called Facebook or Google, you know, has it in for you in particular. Now, they're not likely to be interested in me or in most people, but maybe they would be interested in the president of the United States. So even though I don't believe they are going out of their way to put a lot of negative stuff about Donald Trump on their sites, they don't have to because the algorithm will do it, but I don't think they're going out of their way to do it, but because we can't rule it out, you're right. We have to watch them very, very carefully. We have to know who these people are insofar as we can and do what we can individually as consumers to try to figure out what we're going to do as an alternative. The president wants to start his own Twitter. You've heard about this. People have already started designing little alternatives for the bird. And somebody suggested calling it Trumpter. But if anyone could put the hurt on Twitter overnight, it would be the president, because so many people tune in to Twitter every morning and go first to see what the president has to say. You know, positive and negative. The people who like him the most and the people who like him the least seem to start their day but with whether or not he's been tweeting. You know, he gets up early, by the way. 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, Eastern time, he's there and tweeting about stuff. And I don't think there's anyone editing that stuff. So, if he were to decide to just take his tweets and go home, as it were, and take them to another platform, that would be a big deal. And he would certainly start with a built-in following.
We'll have more from the Q&A between Ron Elving and supporters of our station when WBOI Presents returns. Stay tuned.
Democracy is about choice. The content you hear on 89.1 WBOI is created to help you make informed choices in November and beyond. We're committed to covering the events, the issues, and the candidates, all delivered with the civility and objectivity
that you've come to expect from public radio. This kind of thorough, independent coverage requires resources, because nearly half of 89.1 WBOI's budget comes from listener support. Your commitment is so important. We're in this together. Make your contribution at WBOI.org, and thank you.